We're in the Senate Committee on Education and General Government. Welcome. We are happy to have you here on this very gloomy day, but we hope to make your day brighter with all this great legislation we have for you this morning. We are joined by an interpreter because we have our first bill up, which is Senate Bill 757 regarding the Schools for the Deaf and the Schools for the School for the Blind. And so I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 757. And, you know, Ms. Richardson, I'm just going to have you say we've got an amendment and then have Ms. Hunt come up and give us the lowdown on what we're doing.
So do you want the summary of the bill?
Yes.
At all? Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 757 establishes a governor-appointed, Senate-confirmed Board of Trustees for the Oregon State School for the Deaf. It specifies the board membership and duties. It transfers duties for operating the Oregon State School for the Deaf from the Superintendent of Public Instruction to the board. It authorizes the board to appoint the director of the Oregon State School for the Deaf, and it charges the Department of Education with staffing the board and the director. Declares an emergency and will take effect July 1st, 2007. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and there are -2 amendments before us that legislative council can speak to us.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Hunt, would you come forward, please? Colleagues, I've been working on this bill for weeks. We've had a very large group, work group of stakeholders, and Senator Courtney's office has been involved, Representative Gelser's office has been involved, and we've spent a lot of time on this bill. You know, usually in work groups, not everybody comes out happy. I think the School for the Deaf wanted one additional change that we didn't make, but I think for the most part we have some really good legislation here, though the department is opposed to the task force, but we'll talk about that in a moment. So, Ms. Hunt, why don't you run through it for the committee, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Hunt. I'm a senior deputy legislative counsel. The -2 amendments before you gut and stuff the entire bill. And so today I'm going to go over them at a macro level first so you have a broad overview of what they do. The first thing that they do is establish a task force within the legislature to look at the general governance structure of the School for the Blind, School for the Deaf, its relationship with the Department of Ed, and make some recommendations for the next legislative session. The second thing that the amendments do is they create a board of directors for the School for the Deaf and a board of directors for the School for the Blind. However, these boards of directors, unlike the original bill, are primarily advisory and making recommendations to the Department of Education. The amendments also set up an appeals provision, and what I mean by that, in two very specific areas: the siting of the two schools by the Superintendent of Public Instruction and the selection of a director of the two schools by the superintendent can now be appealed by one of the boards of directors of the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf to the State Board of Education. Then the other three smaller things that the amendments do is it very specifically names the Department of Education as the fiscal agent of these Schools for the Blind and School for the Deaf. It makes it clear that the name of the two schools is the Oregon School for the Blind and the Oregon School for the Deaf. And then it very specifically throughout the statutes calls them schools instead of facilities or agencies or something like that. So that's the amendments in a very broad macro level.
Okay, and that's perfect because that's really what I wanted this morning. There were a lot of details that we had to work out. And the advocates felt very strongly about taking out the word state for Oregon State School for the Deaf and State School for the Blind. And then it was Ms. Hunt who came upon going through the statutes and saw the word facilities, and we talked about it and thought that that was not really an appropriate way to describe these schools, which are really schools. And as you know, colleagues, the history of the School for the Deaf and the School for the Blind go back a long way in Oregon's history. And I appreciate that we're going to be able to carry on the tradition but upgrade them to the 21st century and give them a little more control over their own schools. Let me ask if anyone has any questions of Ms. Hunt, and then I wanted to say one other thing about the task force. Any questions in the committee? Okay, great. Ms. Hunt, you did a yeoman's job, or a yeowoman's job. I really appreciate your work and hanging in there with us. Thank you. Okay, I don't know, did all of you get a copy of the letter I got from the Department of Ed?
Uh-huh.
Okay. The Department of Ed likes everything about the bill but the task force, and I was pretty strong that we needed the task force because one of the things that we're going to explore in the task force is whether to divorce these schools from the Department of Ed and create their own state agency. That occurs in many other states. It was not feasible or practical to explore that in this legislative session because we did not have enough time to do that appropriately. I feel a task force is needed to bring in all the parties and the stakeholders to take a look at that before we come back next session with any recommendation to the legislature, because as you all know, there's no way that we have enough time in a committee hearing to explore these very in-depth issues. Turning the schools into their own state agency is a huge departure from what we have now, and I think it deserves careful study. So I'm pretty hooked to the idea of a task force, despite the objections from the Department of Education, which are noted. Any questions or comments?
Want a motion?
I would.
Madam Chair, I move the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 757.
Senator Cruz moves the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 757. Any further discussion? Okay. So happy about that. So we'll accept those amendments.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 757 as amended to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 757 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Okay, let's take the roll on that just so we get it on the record.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Senator Moore.
Excused.
Senator
Metzger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 757 is on its way to Ways and Means. And I really want to say thank you to all of those people who participated in this work group. It took a lot of time, energy, and effort. The governor's office was very involved. Everyone gave it their utmost attention, and we're going to need you down in Ways and Means. So you have me and Senator Morse on that committee, and we'll see you there. Thank you. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 757. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 752. Yep, I didn't look at my cheat sheet. 752. Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 752 requires professional regulatory boards to generate and publish an annual report on the board licensee complaints. It requires the board to submit a report to Legislative Assembly and Governor and to post a report on the board's website.
Okay, and we have Senator Morissette.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. Senate Bill 752 is somewhat similar in intent to the ombudsperson bill that we heard last week.
Okay.
In that it does require additional reporting of complaints heard. There are some corrections yep. that you're receiving, and if you take, well, first of all, the first page lists the categories of agencies that receive complaints from a variety of sources. On the second page, we are eliminating lines 8, 9, and 10 because that would include other regulatory agencies. I didn't intend that this be added to the bill. Legislative Council did, but it causes a lot of angst, and it is inappropriate to require that they do the same kind of reporting on complaints, so we eliminated that. On page 15, at the suggestion of DAS, we put in formal complaints, which would limit the kind of complaint that to those that we think are important, the formal complaints, not just someone calling in complaining about the thing being told that was for a housing home. So these are formal complaints.
And DAS is Department of Administrative Services.
The Department of Administrative. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Well, that's all right. We just have to be careful.
DHS, Department of Human Services, is
okay.
What I meant to say.
Oh, okay.
The Department of Human Services came to my office and they responded to this bill and said, "Well, we can live with certain things if you make some adjustments, including the removal of lines 8, 9, and 10, formal complaints." Now, as far as what is to be reported. We would number of unresolved complaints by category, and the reason each complaint remains unresolved. So the purpose of this bill is, for instance, if last session I was in Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government, we heard some complaints about the Contractors Board, the Contractors Director was there. I asked questions about some local issue complaints, and he said, "Well, I'll get back to you on that complaint." Well, I didn't hear back. That was a complaint that had gone on for several years, and it was unresolved. And I don't know if it's ever been resolved. There's no record that I know of. The Board of Nursing, for instance, had a number of complaints. The situation with the Board of Nursing is that one of the investigators left. Her case, that the caseload of that person was unfinished. Somebody else had to pick it up. Someone had to be hired to complete the list. It was rather vague. There was some unresolved issues. In meeting with the Board of Nursing after the session started, I looked at their current complaint system and I said, "You guys have a model system now on keeping track of complaints and determining which ones are unresolved and so on and so forth." So progress is being made. I think this is something that needs to be done with all of the agencies listed who receive formal complaints, and we need to know which ones have been resolved during the year, which ones have been carried over, what the penalties, category of penalties are. And that would be something I think that is a public interest. It's good government to let people know where their complaint is. If somebody files a complaint, I would like to put the date of the complaint in. That's not listed here, but I think that hopefully is automatic, because if a complaint is filed in 2003 and it's still unresolved, the date itself should be a red flag. So this is not overly intrusive. It's not something that is going to cause a lot of extra work. It's something that should be done. So I urge you to consider it carefully and support the bill.
Okay. I'll get to you in just a second. Mm-hmm. Senator Morissette, you and I talked about this bill before I agreed to hear it, and one of the concerns I had is that in the Ways and Means process, all of these agencies come to us with their budgets, and many of them come to our subcommittee on education. And they all have to list in there the complaint resolutions, how well they're doing. It's a performance measure. Mm-hmm. But they don't list individual complaints. Is that what you're after here? You want a better response rate with individual complaints?
Madam Chair, yes, I want it by category.
Okay.
Complaints by category, resolution by category, unresolved complaints carried over. I'm on the Ways and Means Subcommittee of Health. We heard the nurses' Board of Nursing budget. We talked about their performance measures. Nowhere did I see a list of complaints received, resolved. If we had asked for it, they would have. Mm-hmm. And I did ask for it in a private meeting, because there is an ongoing issue that is yet to be resolved. And what they showed me was a system that they had set up recently in light of the situation that they went through the last 2 years in terms of, that I already mentioned, the investigator left a lot of unresolved complaints, and they put together a system that wouldn't happen again. That kind of information is not brought to the Ways and Means subcommittees. It simply isn't. If you ask for it, they're going to have to go back and get it and show it to you. I don't think many of the agencies have that compilation of complaints.
Okay. Senator Cruz has a question.
Yeah, a couple, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Senator Morissette, kind of a technical thing. In Section 2A, where you've changed it to formal complaint, I'm just wondering if you should also make that change in B, C, and D to make sure, because that we're talking formal complaint all the way through. This way it reads now, you know, A is referring to formal complaints, and one could assume the others are just referring to complaints in a big picture. So just a suggestion.
Thank you.
If you're looking at amendments, and Madam Chair, the other question would be, Senator, do you have a sense of what the fiscal impact would be? Have you had any discussions on that at all? Because the SMS says yet to be determined. I'm just a curiosity.
Thank you for that question. I think. No, I don't have a sense of the fiscal impact. In fact, I would even want to phase this in over a couple of years, because that, you know, may be a burden for an agency to have to suddenly go back and start spending a lot of time putting something together that they don't quite have. And so I would be willing to put an implementation date on, for instance, in 8 or 10 or whatever. But that's a good point. Frankly, any bill that of mine that I am is going to go to Ways and Means, I'm looking for ways to mitigate a fiscal. If it can then be done by pocket change, that's fine. If it can be eliminated completely by putting on a delayed implementation, I would certainly go that route.
And we've had our issues on another bill with.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Any other questions, of the Senator? All right. Thank you, Senator Morissette. We've got three people signed up to testify after you. They're all neutral on the bill. Sometimes they're a little scary. Okay. David Plunkett. Michael, I can't read your last name. You're with the Landscape Contractor Board. And Pete Shepard. Why don't you all three come up, and then we'll just crank this one up. Okay. Mr. Shepard, why don't you start?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. Senator Morissette asked the Department of Justice to look at both the draft of the bill and the amendments and the bill as it appears, printed bill as it appears before you. We're institutionally neutral because it doesn't directly affect the Department of Justice. It relates to the Department of Justice's mission because the Attorney General has an overall charge to assist the Assembly and consumers in identifying consumer issues that may be of significance for potential lawmaking purposes or changes in policy. We refer consumer complaints often to many, I would wager over time, to all of the agencies that are listed specifically in the bill. And so I can't speak to the fiscal impact or the operational impact on any of the individual agencies listed. We do think that the bill in requiring the form of report that's been described as amended by Senator Morissette's suggested amendments would help the Assembly identify categorical classes of complaints that are arising in different agencies' jurisdictions, and thus would be of utility to the Assembly and to our office in identifying consumer trends and issues that might need to be addressed in the future.
Okay. All right. And who'd like to go next?
Senator Walker and members of the committee, my name is David Plunkett, and I'm the executive director with the Oregon Board of Optometry, and we too are neutral on the bill, and we are one of the agencies affected. we already do this, and many of the agencies on this list already do this. We're one of the semi-independent agencies, and as such, we do special reporting to JLAC, and we've worked very closely with the Joint Legislative Audit Committee over the past two or three biennials on reporting, and we have a fairly comprehensive report that we already submit to Legislative Fiscal. They do a review of that and make a report to the JLAC committee. And in that report, which is under 182.472, there is a section on, whole section on reporting, and many of these issues about, for example, the number and types of complaints received, the number and types of investigations, the number and types of resolutions, the number and type of sanctions imposed, number of days between beginning an investigation and reaching a resolution, all these things we are already collecting information and reporting on. And so we really have no problem with the intent of the bill. We're doing it.
Because you're already doing it.
But
are you doing it, Mr. Plunkett, because you're a semi-independent agency and you have a higher bar to meet and that's a different requirement for you?
Senator Walker, yes.
Okay.
It is a higher bar. We try to be to meet that higher expectation because we are a semi-independent agency, and Mr. Snyder here with me is also one of those, although he is not listed in the bill. But we have made a special effort in working with JLAC and trying to provide reports that are meaningful and that the JLAC committee can review and then report back to the various committees of the legislature.
Okay, great.
So if we could be exempt, or the only thing we really don't want to have to do this in two different formats and do it twice.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Okay, Senator Cruz has a question.
Yeah. Would this change the format of the way you're reporting?
Senator Walker, Senator Cruz, yes, it probably would change the format that we're doing now. And although we also put this on our website, so this I have this information on the Oregon Board of Optometry's website. And may not be quite in this format, but the information is there, and anyone that wants to look at it can. And it's in a little bit different format than we report to JLAC on.
Okay, Mr. Snyder, man with a bad handwriting.
That's been told to me before.
Yeah, that does not look like an N for that second letter at all.
Chair, it could be the chair with the bad eyesight.
No, I have corrective lenses. All right, thank you.
For the record, my name is Michael Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R, with the State Landscape Contractors Board. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify. We are too neutral on this. We are a semi-independent agency and report biennially on this particular issue. January 1 of every even-numbered year, we have to present a comprehensive report. And so even though taking out section lines 8 through 10 evidently releases me from the whole thing, we would... for a semi-independent agency, speaking on behalf of them, would like an amendment possibly to exclude us from this particular statute.
I think what I'm going to do, Mr. Bischoff's in the back of the room. He is Senator Morsett's right-hand person. Oh, and Senator Morsett's still here,
actually,
too.
At this point, he's his left-hand person.
I didn't see Senator Morsett still sitting there. I think we're going to put them to work on trying to figure out if maybe... I mean, if he wants to go forward with this bill, Senator, I would suggest that you make it a uniform reporting requirement that they're already doing, so they have to do it twice. That's very clear that would be a problem. So we'll send this back to Senator Morsett for more work. And thank you, gentlemen, for testifying
thank
this
you
morning.
Very much.
We close the public hearing on Senate Bill 752. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 596.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 596 allows a contracting agency to limit competition for public contracts to certified emerging small businesses. This would apply to contracts that cost $100,000 or less.
Okay. All right. Michael Cobb and Jessica Adamson. Jessica, I still haven't got used to your married name. I think it's you don't appear in front of my committee very often, so.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors.
And I do hope you're still enjoying married life.
Madam Chair, I do very much. Thank you. And it is a pleasure to be here in front of your committee, unfortunately, for the first time this session. So, again, thank you for the opportunity to be here on
Welcome. What
we view as a really great bill for all contractors in the state, particularly those that are certified emerging small business. This emerging small business account is a fund that is funded by 1% of highway contracts, and this is money that ODOT sets aside into this fund, and up until now they've been able to fund contracts in what the industry called sheltered market programs. So the competition for those funds is limited to certain firms, in this case those that are registered as an emerging small business. But the contract amount has been held at a cap of $50,000. Mr. Cobb and I and many others have been working with a group called the Small Business Initiative at ODOT, trying to find ways to expand opportunities for emerging small businesses in the highway construction industry. And one of the things we identified is the fact that at $50,000, you're talking about very small projects, and the opportunity to do these projects is rather limited. There's only so many projects you can let out at that amount, and so it becomes very difficult to really use the fund as aggressively as the department could. So we said, you know, why don't we raise the threshold to $100,000, and they said that would enable them to let out more contracts and provide more opportunities. We appreciate very much Senator Gordley agreeing to introduce this bill on our behalf, and we believe this will add opportunity for small firms to grow and have more opportunities in the highway sector. We believe that's good for the industry as a whole and certainly for these firms, and ask this committee to consider the measure favorably.
Okay, great. We'll hear from Mr. Cobb now.
Yes, good morning, Madam Chair and committee members, and for the record, my name is Michael Cobb. I am the manager of the Office of Civil Rights for the Oregon Department of Transportation, and thank you for this opportunity to come before you and testify, and we do indeed support this bill, as Jessica just said. And just as a little bit of background, the ESP program was established in 1989, and so the $50,000 limit was established at that point in time. The ESB program is one of several tools, if you will, that we use in the interest of economic stimulus through the execution of our construction heavy highway projects and so on. And in looking at that particular amount, as compared to today's market, we see that things have significantly increased. And the testimony, there, you just have a couple of charts. And if I may just quickly jump to those, I went to the Bureau of Labor and Industries and got some information on the hourly rates for just four trades as an example here. And you'll see in January of 1989, the basic hourly rate went from $17 and change to $28 and change, for a 59% increase. When you add fringe benefits onto it, it jumps to a 92% increase. Same, in similar fashion for the cement masons and laborers. Flaggers went from a 97% basic hourly rate to, with fringe, 103%. So we see just on the hourly side alone, $1,989 does not buy us very much.
Those poor people stand out in the sun and the rain.
Absolutely.
And
yes.
They only made $10 an hour in 1989.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'm glad they're getting paid a little bit more these days.
Yes,
that's hard work.
Yeah, we are. Yes, exactly. So this is why we're looking to, to compensate them more in accordance with today's dollars. If you look at some of the material costs here, you'll also see in the second chart, in the Portland area, concrete has gone from 42 cents per cubic yard to 9,510% increase. Rebar, 108% increase. Coarse aggregate, 89%. Structural steel, 76%. Plywood has gone to a whopping 144%, $1,989 compared to today. So bearing that in mind, the $50,000 cap that we currently have, moving to $100,000, would greatly enable us to get more contracts out there and in terms of better bidding and so forth like that, and would enable us to manage more projects. In the 05-07 biennium, we did award 90 contracts, and again, looking at the testimony there, for $2,157,000. So it is indeed a very, very viable program. So in summary, if I just might add, you know, the increase from $50,000 to $100,000 would be great for us to continue our efforts towards economic stimulus through the execution of our heavy highway and bridge construction programs, and would help small businesses in the state.
All right. Thank you. Appreciated the charts and showing the differences. And it's a little bit like trying to show people that the corporate minimum needs to bump up because it hasn't been changed since 1931.
Wow.
So you only went back to 1989. It would have been curious to see what the salary would have been in 1931 for these folks.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a great bill, Senator Morse. And we now have a quorum. Can you review this bill?
Very briefly.
Okay.
I'd like Senator Morris's comments.
You're in the contracting business, or used to be.
Madam Chair, I would move 705-96.
Well, let's go into work session.
Well, if you want to move it.
So you like it.
So you
I'm fine
it.
With it.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, we had great testimony, very articulate and to the point. So
and I apologize.
You.
I was out talking to Senator Morsat. So.
Okay. Great.
Little issue.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you both
for coming.
Thank
we'll
you.
Close a public hearing on Senate Bill 596, and we'll open a work session, and I'll let Senator Morse continue to make that motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move Senate Bill 596 to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Great. Senator Morse has moved Senate Bill 596 to the floor of the Senate with a two-pass recommendation. Any comments, questions, discussion? Okay, Ms. Gravel, call the roll, please.
Senator Westman?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Westman?
Excuse.
Vice President?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 596 received a constitutional majority and is passed to the floor of the Senate. Senator Morris, do you feel comfortable carrying that? Okay, good. I don't know if you're still in the industry, you could benefit. You might may have to. Do you need to declare a potential conflict of interest in committee? Could you ever?
Not on this bill.
Okay.
I don't think he's emerging, and I don't think it was small.
Good. All right. That's too funny. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2630.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2630 permits a state employee or state officer to authorize a deduction from their salary or wages and designate it for the Oregon Veterans Home Account.
Great. I think Mr. McDonald is here to testify to that, and we may have some other folks. Let's find out. Paula Brown.
Senator, we're co-sponsors of this, so we'll probably be voting for it. So.
I think we'll probably like it. All right. Dive in. Who'd ever like to go first?
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2630. I have provided written testimony, and so we'll just highlight some of the key points. The Oregon Veterans Home is a 151-bed facility located in the Dalles. It provides quality nursing and rehabilitative care to Oregon veterans, their spouses, and parents, all of whose children died in military service. The home's been open since 1997 and has served more than 800 veterans and approximately 40 spouses. 11 of those spouses resided in the home at the same time as their veteran spouses did. Financial support for the operation and maintenance of the home comes primarily from the residents. They pay that in a number of ways. Part of that can be from their disability compensation as a result of illness or injury incurred during military service, and then private sources they have available. The home pursues a variety of fundraising activities to retain affordability and enhance the services for our residents at the home. Those include the Veterans License Plate Program, direct solicitations, grants and awards, and the Oregon Charitable Checkoff Program. Passage of House Bill 2630 will provide an additional mechanism for generous Oregonians to make donations to the state's only veterans home. State employees and officers would be afforded a convenient means of donating a portion of their income to the Oregon Veterans Home. This is typically referred to as a payroll deduction. The department appreciates the sponsors of House Bill 2630, their support of the Oregon Veterans Home, and their positive response to the United Veterans Groups of Oregon by responding to their request by sponsoring this bill. The department would certainly welcome this additional opportunity and this tool as a means of increasing donations to the Oregon Veterans Home. Your support is respectfully requested. I'd like to thank you for your time this morning and would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Well, we'll hear from Mr. McDonald first. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Matt McDonald. I represent United Veterans of Oregon. As you know, we have received no funds from the general fund whatsoever for the Oregon Veterans Home, and this is just another method of helping to finance expenses that we incur at the Veterans Home. We support the bill and hope that you do, too.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. I know in my 9 years in the legislature, this has been a constant issue, how to properly fund the Veterans Home. So I think this is a great idea. And I'm sure there are state employees who are willing to contribute in this way. And I thank you. And it's good to see you again so soon after our other pleasurable visit. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you both. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2630 and open a work session.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2630 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2630 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, Ms. Corbell.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Senator Moore.
Aye.
Senator Westland.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Walker.
Aye. House Bill 2630 is approved. And Senator Cruz, since you're a co-sponsor, I'll have you carry it.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, moving right along, House Bill 2086. I'll open a public hearing.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2086 deletes a provision allowing municipal corporations to request that the Secretary of State develop or revise and install accounting systems. It allows the Secretary of State to request copies of contracts, ordinances, and resolutions that authorize annual audits, and replaces references to generally accepted governmental accounting principles with generally accepted accounting principles.
Oh, okay. We've got Phil Hopkins and Chuck Ibner with us this morning. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, Chuck Ibner, Director of the Audits Division, and with me today to testify on the first bill is Phil Hopkins. He's our audit manager for our municipal audit function there at our office.
Okay.
I think we've got a couple bills for you today that are audit bills, which to this point haven't been controversial. So we'll take that and we'll see how it goes.
Well, I don't know. You know, we might be a little bored.
You never know.
We need to just spice it up.
Yeah.
Give it a whirl.
If you don't mind, I'd like to defer to Phil on this bill. This is one that he had spoken to last session, and is again being revisited. We view it very much as a municipal audit cleanup bill, just to make things line up with current practice. So Phil, if you mind.
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Phil Hopkins, and I am an audit manager with the Secretary of State Audits Division. This is strictly a housekeeping bill. There's some language that was created back in the 70s, and some of the professions have changed, some of the language involved. There was also a notion probably about 30 years ago that the Secretary of State, in trying to help local governments devise and install accounting systems, that there was a need that we could help them if they would call upon us. But the reality is they never have. Accounting systems evolved, you know, tremendously in the last 30 years. And when they do make any changes, they usually go to some other, well, either their own outside accountant or some other source. So they never have called upon us. And so all we're doing is kind of, as I say, just kind of cleaning up the law involved in here. The other part has to do with contracts. It has always been a requirement by the audits division that when a local government contracts for an independent audit, that the contract be in writing, and in fact, by rule, we have certain minimum language that we want included in the contract. The current law requires that they file copies of those contracts with our office, and it really doesn't serve any purpose. There was a point when we would check to make sure that they would include the minimum language, but contracts have gotten so much more complicated nowadays, where we would have like a page of requirements. There sometimes are 15, 20 pages long that has all the terms and conditions. And the point is that all it does is create a filing problem for us and for the firms. I can, because I go out to these firms and I visit them during the year, I can check to make sure there is valid contracts in place. So it's just an unnecessary filing of paperwork. So that's why it doesn't eliminate the provision to require written contracts. It only eliminates the provision to file copies with us.
Okay.
As Director Hibner said, last session this was totally uncontroversial. I've given it to the Board of Accountancy, checked with the Oregon side, CPAs. Nobody has any issues with this.
Why didn't it pass last session then?
Senator Walker, what happened last session was that in another committee, this bill was used, and several other amendments were added to it, and it just kind of died.
It had one of those relating clauses.
Yeah, don't give her any ideas.
It fell on its own weight.
Okay.
Is this the same relating clause? Is this a narrower one than we had last time?
It's narrower. Municipal audits now.
Yeah. Well, I looked at that and I thought...
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, I believe it pertains just to this bill.
Madam Chair, I've noticed that a whole lot of bills drafted this session are drafted to be mischief-proof.
I had some difficulty finding the bill I needed, but I found it. It just took a little while. all right, great. Any other questions for these gentlemen? Okay, well, you can just stay right there as we go into work session because you're coming up next. So I'll close a public hearing on House Bill 2086 and open a work session.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2086 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendations.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2086 to the floor of the Senate with due pass recommendation. Any comments? Okay, Ms. Gravel.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Courtesy, no.
Aye.
Aye. Yeah.
Make him carry.
He is. He's going to carry all three of these. The bill passes, and Senator Wesson, you're carrying it.
I think this will be the second time he's carried a bill he voted against out of this committee. So.
Yeah.
And Chuck, just so you know, I have a perfect record in carrying bills on the floor.
I appreciate that.
Making them pass that I voted no on.
I do see Mr. Hibner twitching, so you better not let him down.
We have faith in Senator.
Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2088. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2088 directs the Secretary of State to take reports of waste, inefficiency, or abuse that are submitted other than through their government waste hotline. It stipulates that the identity of the person making the report by any method is to be kept confidential. Okay. Mr. Hibner. Mr. Hopkins, you disappeared on this one. You don't need to be here on this. All right, thank you for your testimony last time. Mr. Hibner?
Chair Walker again, Chuck Hibner, Director of the Audits Division. This bill is, as you may or not know, we've been managing the Oregon Hotline for quite some time. When it first was devised, the an 800 number was what was considered and conceived and really put into effect. Since then, technology has changed. We now take complaints, hotline complaints over the internet. In discussions with the Department of Justice, with our attorney, as to how far the protections go included in the bill, protections for confidentiality and other things, it does not extend to anything other than people who phone in on that specific 800 number. They could call in on any other line and technically would not be afforded the protections of the hotline statute. So what we are proposing is that we broaden the language in such a way that no matter how we receive a complaint, that is in effect a hotline type of complaint on fraud, waste, and abuse. It's characterized in that way, that the sort of protections that would be allowed someone who called in on the 800 number would also be allowed for those that file via the our web presence, which since we're offering that, we would appreciate that. And also if they were just to call on any other line, walk into the office, any source, we just think it makes sense. So
thank you. I love this hotline. Do you have any way of telling us how much money you've saved or what kind of crime you've uncovered? I know that it's been useful and mm-hmm. productive. So give us a sampling if you could.
Senator Walker, we have... We're just about ready to issue our next hotline report. I wish I could remember what I read. If I'm remembering the statistics right, we received over 600 hotline calls. A lot of those. In fact, I'd say a majority are just people who would prefer not to pay their taxes and just found an 800 number to call in on. But a good share of them do have some merit to it, and we will spend some time trying to divine whether it's an audit issue, whether it's something just needs to be forwarded to an agency, and or otherwise. You get down to 8, 10, maybe a dozen during any given year that we will take significant action on that may result in audit reports. In terms of dollars saved, we do have some specific instances where 50, 60, $70,000 in a given setting was identified and recaptured. We've had a couple reports recently that at least one where someone was convicted. We were involved in helping identify the extent of the loss, help the agency to develop additional controls to keep it from happening again, and that really is our function on these things. In terms of dollars to date, I can get you that figure, and it shows up every year in our report. I believe it's somewhere in the couple million dollar range, but I wouldn't.
Right.
Be
well,
able
that
to
might be
swear
helpful to
that.
Senator Weston
sure.
when he carries the bill.
Yeah, I'll send him all the reports so he has a fair sampling to choose from.
And the cost of the system to operate it is minuscule, correct? It's just simply a telephone number and you have a website. And
as far as that goes, Chair Walker, that would be true. The cost of staff to spend the time researching these things and spending on them, it has been, it has been something that we've had to take our existing resources and devote. And when we first started the hotline, we maybe had half an FTE who was fielding these things and following up on them. With the increased popularity of the hotline, we now have internally budgeted for FTE to handle the hotline and all the calls. We've really had to ramp up to deal with these things, and unfortunately, we did not get extra staff. So these are folks are coming from our other what we could characterize discretionary activities. Our performance auditing and IT auditing functions to make sure that we get these things taken care of. But it has been an interesting undertaking on our part to get enough staff devoted to be able to take care of these in a timely way.
But the system does pay for itself.
I would characterize it that way. But again, even if it's just close or maybe a little under, I think that the ability to help government put in these controls, even if the loss is small, you get a huge impact, and all agencies can benefit from the sort of things we issue in terms of controls, how to detect fraud, mm-hmm. How to even just eliminate or limit waste. I think there's a value above just maybe any dollars that we
I
might
agree.
Identify.
I think it's a good public value. Senator Morris has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is kind of an interest question. Did the Department of Corrections purchasing problem emerge through your office, or was that through a different venue?
Chair Walker, Senator Morris, that was not reported through us. And I think if you were to look statistically at the number of these sorts of things that are identified, it typically involves a tip. Not all tips come to us. I believe it was a case where either the corrections identified it themselves or a federal entity maybe had a hand in it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
But it didn't come through us.
That's a good question. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I fully support this, and I think it's appropriate. I guess I'm just using this as an opportunity to wish that we had similar protections for legislators who get tips or emails from state employees or whoever. And at this point in time, that's public information, and which is a problem for us. And so I'm hoping at some point in time, as you all know, Madam Chair, we have some issues that are unresolved. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I have fought tooth and nail if anyone thinks they're going to get information that someone gives to me that they consider confidential and private because they want to expose some fraud or
absolutely.
Abuse or something in a state agency. So we continue to discuss that as a public records issue. Okay. No further questions. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2088. I'll open a work session.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2088 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation to be carried by Senator Westland.
Senator Cruz makes a motion to approve House Bill 2088 and send it to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation to be carried by Senator Westland. Any discussion? Okay, we'll call the roll.
Senator Metzger? I'm not worried about the bill. I'm worried about the carrier.
Senator, I'm the motion.
Aye. Senator, we all are.
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator
Westland?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Madam Chair, I won't make that addendum to the next motion because it gives the committee some pause, but I will vote aye.
Okay, I vote aye, and I have every confidence that Senator Westland will do us proud. Bill 2088 is on its way. Thank you.
Chuck, I make no representations about bills I support in committee.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hibner. All right. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2238. We're just rolling right along. That agenda looks scary.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2238 eliminates the requirement that councils of government send copies of budget documents to the Department of Revenue for further filing with the Secretary of State Audits Division. It applies to documents filed for fiscal years beginning on or after July 1, 2007, declares an emergency, and would take effect upon passage.
Great. We have John Phillips from the Department of Revenue. We didn't even draw a crowd this morning. We have to send out banners and balloons and something. Mr. Phillips, how are you?
Very good, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you for hearing this bill. It's a very simple bill. It's part of the governor's regulatory streamlining package. It just eliminates certain entities of local government from sending in budgets that we file and hold for a year and then send on to the Secretary of State's Audits Division to hold and hang on to for a year or two or three. And then, and so we think it's an efficiency issue, and we ask for your support. I'd be happy to go into lengthy detail on any part of it if you'd like or answer any questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I don't have any questions or necessity of lengthy detail.
I don't either because the written testimony is very clear, and it is a simple bill. Any other questions? Mr. Phillips, you did a great job this morning. Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2238. And take a motion. After I open the work session.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2238 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2238 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any questions, comments? Okay, Ms. Gravel. He's excused, but he's going to be carrying it.
Senator
Morris?
Aye.
Senator Westman? I vote I with the proviso that Jeff Cruz carries the bill.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2238 passes. And no, I'm going to give this one to Senator Metzger.
Cindy, might be a no on the floor.
I'll be a passionate yes on the floor.
Okay. All right.
So all right. It's an empty threat, basically.
And colleagues, we have to stand at recess because we need to find Senator Avakian, who has the last two bills.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would request the opportunity to cast a vote on Senate Bill 757.
Oh, sure. We'll reopen the work session on Senate Bill 757 to allow Senator Morris to cast a vote. How do you vote? Or any objection?
No, we need to, Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended to allow Senator Morris to cast a vote on Senate Bill 757.
I'm so glad I have a left-hand person here. Senator Cruz moves that we suspend the rules to allow Senator Morris the opportunity to vote on Senate Bill 757. Any objection? Hearing none. Senator Morris, how do you vote?
Vote aye.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Reclose the work session.
Madam Chair?
And you'd like to...
Would you like me to change my vote on whatever bill it was?
No.
2086.
No, I think it's appropriate that you carry a vote.
Oh, 2067.
I've already done that.
All right. So we are, if we're done with that, we will stand at ease while we try to locate. Public hearing on both Senate Bill 736 and SJM 12. Ms. Richardson, why don't you give us the lowdown?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 736 requires the State Board of Education to annually identify whether Oregon will receive adequate federal funding to implement the federal No Child Left Behind Act. It prohibits state and local education agencies from expending monies or entering into contracts or agreements to implement the No Child Left Behind Act if the board finds that the federal funding will be inadequate, declares an emergency, and would take effect upon passage. Joint Memorial 12 urges Congress to amend the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001 to provide a waiver and adequate federal funding.
Okay, and we have a very esteemed guest here this morning.
We also have Senator Avakian.
Representative Comp didn't make it. I'll do what I can.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brad Avakian, State Representative, District 17.
You're not a state representative anymore. You were elevated.
Did I say that?
Yes,
yeah,
you did.
Just said Representative Comp. It must have slipped in. State Senator, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Committee, I appreciate you hearing these bills. I've proposed them the last couple sessions. I've never pushed them hard, even though the concept is very dear to my heart, and I understand, Madam Chair, that you would like to move the memorial and not the other, which I am in full support of, and I appreciate that. I thought what I could do for you is just very briefly tell you why I presented the bills. Won't go into all the reasons, all the concerns regarding No Child Left Behind, but with especially with regard to the memorial, why I think it's an important bill for you to be considering. The bills are proposed because I have viewed the No Child Left Behind Act, regardless of the content of the act, as a wholly inappropriate imposition of federal government into an issue that has historically been the province of the states. And so I see this as a states' rights issue even more than I do an educational policy issue. There have been a number of states around the country that have proposed similar legislation to this based on that notion of state sovereignty. There certainly is a place for the federal government in the management of many affairs that affect us at the state government level and at the local government level, but virtually none in the history of the country that has been so sovereign as the management of a public education system, which has been the province of the state. The reason, especially the No Child Left Behind Act, has been so difficult in this regard is that it sets specific standards on which the states are to meet, and both in terms of testing and both in terms of curriculum. For instance, the No Child Left Behind Act requires only math, science, and English. There are other things it encourages states to do, but that's all that it requires. And then sets up a series of standardized testing for states to prove that they're accomplishing certain goals in those areas. we under the United States Constitution don't have to follow the No Child Left Behind Act if we don't want to, like virtually any other federal regulation that we're not in conflict with. But it's tied to roughly $600 million in federal funding that flows to the state of Oregon. So what the federal government has done is it has implemented a policy that has so much money attached to it that the states bootstrap themselves into being tied to that money for their very survival with their public education system. And that, in my opinion, is not an appropriate relationship with sovereign states to the federal government under our constitutional model. The reason for the memorial is because I think that if the No Child Left Behind Act is to stay in effect, that states that have historically an excellent educational system, which Oregon has had if you look over the past several decades, that those states ought to be exempt from the standards. Oregon has been nationally recognized up until the last 8 or 9 years with their exceptional music and arts programs in their school system. We have had the highest SAT scores in the nation until recently. Well-rounded curriculum, excellent teachers, and which heightens, I think, the inappropriateness of a federal standard that changes our method of teaching kids. And so the memorial is presented to you to urge Congress to take another look at states like Oregon with a history of excellence in education and exempt us from those federal standards. The other bill, since you're not going to move, I will save the committee's time, not comment on unless there are questions from the committee.
Well, I'd just like to ask you, the other bill just says that we're going to exempt ourselves from the act. I'd just like to ask you, I know that Utah is one bold and brave state that's thumbed its nose at the federal government over NCLB. Is there any other state in the country that's done the same thing?
There are a long list of states that have held hearings, proposed bills, not a lot of them that have had success in passing a bill disconnecting. Utah's effort was one of the most significant, and it was primarily based on the state's rights issue as opposed to educational policy. If you were to get on the net or otherwise look up the floor speeches that occurred in Utah and the committee speeches that occurred in Utah, it sounds a lot like the South seceding from the Union at the time of the Civil War when they felt that the North was imposing itself on Southern policies. And frankly, I think it was an excellent, excellent debate, like I would like to see us have in Oregon, about the whole structure of the democracy in this country, where you are not to have a strong, centralized federal government that dictates policy to the states, but that, in fact, you are to have strong state governments that unite, in essence, United States, in order to support certain federal powers. And that is what happened in Utah, mm-hmm. and you see it happening in Idaho, in Nevada. There was some in California, and then a number of other states across the country.
I know that Vermont is currently looking at seceding from the Union as well, but not over this issue.
Well, and to be very clear, I'm certainly not suggesting Oregon secede from the Union, but in this particular, I would like to see a little
foreign aid would be awfully good.
Might get more money from the Fed.
That's true. We might get more money as a foreign country.
Right. There is a role for the federal government, too. We pay taxes to the federal government. The federal government ought to give some of those taxes back to the states, the roughly $600 million they give us to help with our Title I schools and others, is money that should be coming back to us. My opposition is that it should not be tied to mandates from the federal government that they do not fund on how we teach all of our children.
And I believe that it's more than $600 million. I think it's about $1 billion.
You know what? I'm using the figure from 2 years ago, and
yeah,
it probably
it's up
is
to
more
about
now.
$1 billion now. So it'd be a chunk of change. Any questions? You want to engage in a little debate here, Senator Cruz?
I do not want to engage in a debate because I totally agree with the senator. And this is the tip of the iceberg. I mean, the federal government uses dollars to tie themselves to a lot of areas that are states' rights areas. There's no question about that, this being one of them. And I agree with that. And I have considered whether the state of Oregon should just say no to No Child. And unfortunately, if the No Child dollars were a separate funding stream, we might make the case for doing that. But they do tie into Title I and these other funds. And so I think the impact of saying no at this point, the way it's structured, would be significant, and which is unfortunate. They tie too many mandates together, even though they're unrelated. And I would also agree that the education of our children is not the business of the federal government, and they should not be placing all these requirements. And it's costing us a lot of money to comply with No Child. Clearly is. And the ramp-up of the system and the changes in the system are huge and significant. There's no question about that. But I would also maintain that ultimately education is a local issue, and I would opine that the State Department of Education probably has put more requirements on local schools than might be appropriate as well.
I don't disagree with that, Madam Chair, and Senator Cruz, I don't disagree with that. You bring up a notion, and so did you, Madam Chair, that relates back to the other bill. And if I may just make a comment regarding that.
Sure.
Although I've proposed the other bill for a couple sessions in a row now, I've never liked it. The reason I don't like it is because what it does is it orders our Department of Education to not abide by No Child Left Behind if it isn't fully funded. When the core of my belief is really that I don't want it funded. I don't think we should have to abide by it at all. And I would sooner disconnect than demand funding and then compliance by the state. But there's a reason that I feel that way with respect to educational policy in addition to the state's rights issue. The overemphasis on math, science, English in combination with standardized testing has done a couple things to our educational system with it, which has significantly hurt our children. One of them is when you tie the money to math, science, and English, and where that's where you focus your testing, it leads to the elimination of music, art, physical education, shop classes, many of the things that used to be part of the core curriculum of public education in Oregon across the state. And those that I just mentioned, that in many ways have been largely eliminated, eliminate with it a very large piece of early childhood development and human development. You cannot take music, art, cultural exposure, and physical education away from kindergarten through third graders and expect them to develop into well-rounded good citizens for the state of Oregon. Because they need that. They need that exposure. If you're one who believes in standardized testing, exposure to music in grades K through 3 sharply increased standardized test scores in math and science in the older grades. You get a bigger bump in with that type of curriculum exposure than you do with full-day kindergarten. So, and there are many, many early childhood studies to support that. As an example, in my district, the Beaverton School District, we used to have full bands and full orchestras in every one of our elementary schools. We used to have drama departments in the middle schools. Every single one of those programs has been fully eliminated. They don't exist anymore. Physical education has gone halftime from what it was 10 years ago. Math and science, on the other hand, has increased and the time devoted to it during the day. Now, I'm not saying that those math and science is not important. They're incredibly important for a lot of reasons. But you must have a balance between that curriculum, especially in the early grades, if you want well-developed good citizens later in life. We don't have that anymore, and we don't have it because of the imposition of the No Child Left Behind Act. The last piece that I would comment on with regard to the loss, potential loss of federal funding, when I think about that concept of our dependence on it, I think back to the state motto, which is, she flies with her own wings, and really makes me wonder how independent, how sovereign, how often we really do fly with our own wings anymore in situations like this. Because we don't. We have folded our wings and nested in order to achieve $1 million in money from the federal government. We're not independent. We've given up that sovereignty. And not only for policy reasons, but for the state's rights issues that I mentioned earlier, that is a very, very sad thing for Oregon. For those that believe in the No Child Left Behind Act, there is no reason why we could not adopt those standards as our own and manage them on our own, sovereign from the federal government. But we've chosen not to do that, and we've chosen not to do it in order to achieve the federal money. So, I appreciate you hearing the memorial very much, and I appreciate you willing to take it out of this committee to the floor.
Madam Chair, just a short follow-up.
Sure, and then Senator Morris.
Okay, and I'm going to reference a comic strip in the Oregonian where they're talking about the new state test, and the child, the first thing he says, so our report cards don't count. Which I found informative, and then in I think 2 days later they said, so these standardized tests are going to, because they said these will inform the people of the deficiencies in CT. The question was, so how do these standardized tests tell them that we need a new roof or other issues like that? So it is a matter both from the perspective of federal requirements, but also perspective of the state system as to what we're testing, how much it costs to do that, and whether that money could be more appropriately spent in other areas of the education system, whether it be infrastructure or expanded curricula.
Okay, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This discussion, tangential to your bill but related, came up in our education subcommittee when we were looking at the Department of Education, and I raised the question, and it wasn't entirely a rhetorical question, is if you look at what monies are received from the federal government and what monies are spent, what is the difference, and is it a difference that is insurmountable? One of the things that has occurred, with the growth of federal law and regulations, and the aftermath of Measure 5 and that same effect occurring within our state, where we migrate more and more and more to central authority. And the school boards and the local jurisdictions are left responding to that in a way that costs money. And what occurs to me in looking at the relating clause in 736, and I would just raise this issue if it's something that Senator Vakian and the committee might feel is worth pursuing, is to attempt to quantify the expression that was provided me after the hearing to the effect that we spend more time weighing the lamb than we do feeding the lamb. So the disproportion of this control and regulations and reports and mandates, what is that cost? What is that cost? And maybe that's something we should attempt to quantify. And this bill has the right relating clause. It says relating to federal education law. Maybe that's the first step in taking eventual this step that you have in this bill, is an attempt to actually understand what those costs truly are. Because I believe they're profound when you look at all of the things that what we've built up within our own Department of Education in response, what local units of government have built up in response, and what it's costing us in diverted time. You have real costs that, where you have people directly doing these things. You have indirect costs, and those indirect costs are when you re-divert by federal mandate from doing what you're talking about, a balanced to more, you know, focused. Is that something that would be worth pursuing?
Personally, I think yes. To quantify that, Madam Chair, if I could, because, you know, how much of the energy FTE time spent in our Department of Education is tied directly to feeding the federal bureaucracy with data that, I mean, in a comprehensive way, we know there is a lot of money and energy spent that really does not have anything to do with directly educating kids. And a lot of that is driven by the federal government. And so I've wondered about that, Senator Morris, myself, for a long time. It would be nice to be able to, you know, your concept, Senator, is a good one, if we could put numbers to it.
Madam Chair, I agree with you completely, and I am very encouraged by the comments the committee is making. I am not a big one for interim work groups and task forces and things like that. I like it when we get in here and just do the work.
And but we had the luxury of spending a little time on that this morning, which I think has evoked this kind of discussion.
But I think this is an excellent type of a project for an interim work group or committee. And if the committee wanted to do something like that, even informally, it's something that I would very much like to be a part of. With regard to cost, without sounding too esoteric about the notion of cost, I think it's very important to realize the financial cost that you're talking about, especially with regard to like FTEs or time away from actual teaching that teachers need to have in order to grade the tests and develop tests. But attached to that financial cost is a huge human cost in the relationship between the teacher and the pupil. Because it is true that teachers are spending so much time trying to abide by the requirements that are being handed down to them, that they don't have the ability to create the personal relationship with the student that they used to be able to when they could spend that time sitting down and reading one-on-one with kids or two-on-one with kids, helping them work through in a personal tutoring fashion how to do the math equations. That is good not only to teach the children information, but it's good to teach them relationship building with adults. And that is something that we are largely missing today, and the teachers I talk to that have been around for a couple decades know it.
Yep.
They remember the way it used to feel when they would walk into a classroom and have those kind of relationships with their students. And that has been replaced with this standardized approach to running kids through the cattle chute. And so I think as we look into that financial impact, we're going to see how it also impacts the human factor in teaching kids.
Senator, it's a lot like a symphony. When you talked about that we don't have math, music, art, PE, those shop, those things, that is the symphony. We're only teaching to part of it. It's like not having the violin section. We only have the horns and the drums and maybe a clarinet or two with math and science, and we've left out the whole part.
It's one of my greatest fears about where society is headed, Madam Chair, is I envision us 30, 40, 50 years from now having a much cultureless society than what we have now, because we have grown generations of children that did not have the exposure to those types of things at the early ages. I think it will have a severe impact on society. Mm-hmm. And we are only in the infancy of it now, so we don't see the result. But we will see the result someday. And so we need to be thinking in this regard.
My husband and I asked our children to play a musical instrument. We just said, you will play a musical instrument in middle school. So we said, choose your instrument. So for 3 years, they each chose an instrument, and they were in band. Sarah also plays piano, and they still have that interest in music, a huge interest in music. One of the middle schools in our community just announced they were cutting their band program, and now it will be a before-school activity. And so any child who's not able to get to school before school starts can no longer participate in band. Band is like every kid participate. I never was able to. We couldn't afford an instrument, but, you know, it's part of who we are. It's just part of the maturation process and creating the symphony. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, could we continue this discussion, bring this bill back, request that the Department of Education come in and talk about the possibility of quantifying the direct and indirects with this No Child Left Behind, and to try to get at kind of some basic information with this issue.
Okay.
We have a bill here, I think, to do it. If it was the pleasure of the chair and the committee.
Yeah. Let's. I Senator Metzger needs to get to a work group, so I'd like to just quickly have you respond to that, and then I'd like to go into a work session on your other bill.
Okay. And actually, I was going to suggest if you could potentially pass the measure out and have them come in and testify on the other bill that you're not moving. Or just move it, and then after the end of the month, when you don't have the crunch of getting your Senate bills out, have them come in for an informational hearing on the topic. But I think it would be good to have the measure going to the floor as we bring them in to discuss everything you're talking about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator. It's been a very great conversation this morning.
Before we go into work session, and Senator Rocky leaves, something occurred to me because the retention rate of teachers and the fact that so many of them leave the profession in the first 3 or 4 years, I think we would find that they get into the profession to teach and find that they're bureaucrats. And so, I mean, you talk about ancillary effects. I think that clearly would be one in this, because if you have a passion for teaching kids and you spend a significant amount of your time filling out reports, that's got to be incredibly unsatisfying.
Mm-hmm. Representative Compson here regrets, Madam Chair, she was going to testify on the bill with me too, but
okay.
It was tied up.
Thank you, Senator. We'll close the public hearing on SB 736 and SJM 12. We'll open a work session on SJM 12.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Joint Memorial 12 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Adoption. Okay. Senator Cruz moves adoption of Senate Joint Memorial 12 and asks that we send it to the floor.
With a due pass recommendation.
Might not be adopted.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah, and that's what I tried to say. We all got it. Any further discussion? Okay, Ms. Gravel, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Westman?
He's excused. Vice
Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Hey, Senate Joint Memorial 12 is on its way, and we approve of it. It's going to the Senate floor, and Senator Vakian, you're going to carry it, and I'm looking forward to a very eloquent speech because I think you're very good at doing that. All right.
But before we close the hearing,
let me close the work session on SJM 12.
I'm delighted to carry Senate Bill 596. It's Senator Gordley's bill. If she wanted to carry it, that's fine. I'm delighted to carry it. But
I think she just offered to introduce it. I don't think she went into the bill. So
it's not a priority for
her. Okay, great.
Madam Chair, this was a very, very good discussion.
Yeah, you know, I'm really glad, colleagues, that we just stopped for a minute. We didn't have to rush to get all these bills out. And we got to pause and reflect what this committee is all about.
Yeah. So you were wondering we should have scheduled more. You scheduled just the right number.
We did.
You know, the issue really is one of centralization.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And is it good or is it bad?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what Senator Cruz talks about.
And to have some kind of a thoughtful reflection, what we're doing to our own school districts by what we do is in the same vein as what the federal government is doing to us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a very old-fashioned view of education.
Well, you know what? It's refreshing because I think we're so focused on what you say here is becoming bureaucrats and teaching to the test. And
we're focusing on the wrong things. We're weighing the lamb
rather
than feeding the lamb. And I thought that was a great statement.
That is nice. And Senator Walker and I have been having this conversation for a long time now. Mm-hmm.
And,
so,
you know, my son is getting ready to enter a master's program to become a teacher. And I know my son. He's very thoughtful, like most teachers. He's just full of great ideas. And I just don't, I'm hoping he's not going into the slaughter, because I don't want him to lose that imagination and end up just teaching to the test. I don't want that.
I agree.
We have so many creative people who get into the field of teaching because they love children, and they love sharing that knowledge with them. And gosh, I hope we can recapture that.
Thank you for this opportunity to have a reflection.
Sure, you're welcome. Enjoy the rest of your morning. We're adjourned. Thank you for coming.